Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Over the course of a week, three mass shootings in Gilroy, California, El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, renewed a sense of despair, fear, sadness, and anger for many Americans. Officials are investigating two of the incidents as domestic terrorism, and the suspected shooter in El Paso is said to have expressed anti-immigrant and anti-Hispanic views. In a few minutes, we'll come together to talk about dealing with trauma and grief and what action you may be taking in reaction to these events. On Monday, President Trump gave a prepared speech where he condemned racist ideologies.
The shooter in El Paso posted a manifesto online consumed by racist hate. In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Hate has no place in America. Hatred warps the mind, ravages the heart, and devours the soul.
President Trump went on to say that he has instructed the FBI to identify resources necessary to disrupt hate crimes and domestic terrorism. These words were in contrast to many of the remarks the president has made in the past. Yesterday, I spoke with Vermont Congressman Peter Welch, and I asked him if there was a way to use the president's remarks on Monday to push him for action to curb the rise in violence attributed to white nationalism, including the possible motive of the suspected shooter in El Paso.
The president's words in that speech were fine, but they're not credible because his entire career, essentially, from when he began running and even before, has been to stoke up these divisions.
Does the fact that he said those words mean that you have an opening to essentially call him on it and make him and make Republicans take action?
Yes, it does, and we should follow through on that. The president in the past has used good words after an event like Charlottesville, but then followed it up with very disruptive comments about there's good on, quote, both sides. And there is no good on neo-Nazi views. But we should do everything that we can to follow up, and it should start with some common sense gun legislation. You know, the House has passed a strong background check bill that is sitting in the Senate. Mitch McConnell won't bring it up. And, you know, you contrast what's happening with the stonewalling there with what happened in Vermont after we had that near tragedy at Fairhaven. We had a Democratic legislature and our Republican governor, Phil Scott, who came together to pass very significant gun safety legislation. So I'd like to see us follow through on that with actions, not just words.
So the background check legislation could move forward. Are you hearing your Republican colleagues talk at all in a different way after these two shootings over the weekend? I've heard some Republican legislators speaking differently about their stances on firearms restrictions.
Well, they are. But keep in mind that when we passed this in the House, we had Republican support. I mean, this is a common sense step. Do a background check before somebody gets a gun. And many Republican senators, Tim Scott, has indicated that he would go back to Washington and support that. Mitch McConnell is stonewalling, and the president is not giving it the support that we need from the president. And essentially, this should be done on a bipartisan basis. We should be talking about these weapons of war. I mean, this shooting that happened in Dayton, in 32 seconds, nine people were killed. And that is a result of having a weapon of war in the hands of a person who is totally disturbed in intent on slaughtering innocent individuals.
Would a gun buyback program have to be part of any real solution to gun violence in America, given the fact that the Global Arms Survey estimates that there are nearly 400 million firearms owned by American civilians at the end of 2017? That's about 120 guns per 100 people.
Well, I think two things. One, whatever law we pass is not going to, quote, solve the problem. But there is a situation in this country that's unique, and that is that we've got about 5% of the world's population and almost 50% of all the guns. And the easy access to these guns, especially these automatic weapons, makes it very simple for somebody who's quite disturbed to do an immense amount of slaughter in a very short period of time. So I think we do have to pass, finally, some common sense gun safety legislation. But I also think there's cultural challenges that we face. I mean, the president's rhetoric that whips up this white nationalist sentiment is very, very dangerous. Also, I think we've got to address what is domestic terrorism and name that. You know, since 9/11, the focus and massive amounts of resources have been spent on protecting the homeland from international terrorists. But in that time, since 9/11, about as many people or a little few more have been killed by domestic terrorists than international terrorists. And yet we have no tracking system here to follow domestic terrorism. We don't have a coordinated approach. We just leave it all to the FBI. We don't have the resources in our local law enforcement agencies to assist them in trying to track what is going on in the white nationalist community. So I think that there has to now be a focus on this domestic threat that is emerging.
I want to double back to that question of a buyback just to get an answer. But also, are you started that answer thinking about gun legislation and a culture of guns in America and moved it to white nationalism. So do you see the connection or a connection between guns and racism and white nationalism?
I see what happens with the easy access to guns is that anybody who is disturbed and then comes to the decision that they want to do real damage. I mean, we had that in Fairhaven, where this young man wanted to have the highest body count of a killing in a high school, or with this white nationalist who appears to be the shooter in El Paso. And if those people have easy access to guns, that makes a tragedy much more likely to happen. And as far as the buyback is concerned, that is something we could definitely consider. It's voluntary. People could turn in guns, and that might help in some respects. But I also think that the massive number of guns out there means that none of us can have total confidence that any specific action, one thing, even the background check is necessarily going to end it. But we should do the things that we can do where we're making a societal commitment to take real care before a person is allowed to have a firearm. They should have a background check so we have some confidence that that person is going to use it responsibly. And, of course, the vast number of people who own guns do that.
In thinking about how to curb hate speech and the whipping up of a frenzy of somebody, whether it's white nationalism or other extremist views, would you advocate for the censorship or the shutting down of websites like 8chan, where the El Paso suspect reportedly spent time, or more censorship within social media sites like Twitter and Facebook?
I don't support infringing on First Amendment rights, but I do support public officials, starting with the president, to speak with compassion instead of division. You know, the country always is in need of a leader who uses our office of highest public trust to promote unity, not division. And that makes a difference. And the president's rhetoric, you know, from his campaign forward has been very divisive, and that has real consequences. You know, hate speech will lead to hate crimes, and people will feel authorized. Disturbed people who hear a validation of their disturbed ideas will act, and we've seen that.
Do you think the president has used hate speech, and do you think that hate speech has directly led to violence?
The president has used hate speech. I mean, when he calls all Mexicans rapists, when he has a ban on Muslims on the basis of the religion, when he totally contradicts the Martin Luther King admonition that we treat people with respect on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin, that is hate speech in my mind. And hate speech, I think, contributes. It's not as though the hate speech is what pulls the trigger, but it provides the powder that makes a bad outcome more likely.
And yet there are people, civilians and people who work in the government, who continually denounce the things that President Trump says, say they're racist, say they're hateful, and yet he still continues to speak that way. And there doesn't seem to be anything that prevents him from speaking that way. So what can be done?
Well, the president can speak. He chooses his words, and he does it deliberately. And none of us can stop him, and it's not as though there's a law that can stop him. I mean, there's going to be an election, and voters are going to be able to render a verdict on their approval or disapproval of the way the president is using the bully pulpit of that office. And that's really going to be the ultimate outcome. But all of us who have positions, and every citizen can, I think, stand up for inclusion, stand up for kind of Vermont values of mutual respect, civil discourse, and equality of treatment.
A final question for you, Representative Welch. There's no one in America, or at least no one with rational thought and even an ounce of empathy, who thinks that this kind of mass violence is at all okay. But there are a lot of differences of opinion across the country about what would work to help curb the levels of violence and hate we're seeing. And we can include in that gun violence that's not counted in mass shooting numbers, other forms of violence, hate speech, bullying, the intimidation directed at people of color, immigrants, trans people. I mean, the list goes on. So clearly no singular focus is going to solve a pervasive level of hate and animosity. What else would you include in an all-in approach that incorporates some of the things we've talked about today and also addresses poverty, mental health parity, and other things that contribute to this?
Well, first of all, I think each and every one of us has a responsibility to have mutual respect to our neighbors, and you got to start there. Secondly, public officials have to speak with respect about all people and not make these invidious distinctions on the basis of the color of their skin or their religion. Third, I think we do have to have law enforcement focusing on what is a domestic threat, and it's fanned in some cases by Russia interfering as it did in our last election. It's fanned by folks who get on the dark net. And it would make sense to me that we start tracking this and monitoring that activity in an effort to head off whenever we possibly can a tragedy. To some extent, that happened in Fairhaven because there was very good response by the school officials and by our law enforcement officials. And then you followed that up with the action that Governor Scott and the Democratic legislature took, bipartisan, on gun safety. And it gives people some hope that their elected officials are trying to take some action. People are realistic. They know that there's not, quote, a law that can solve everything, but they want to see that we're sharing the same goal of trying to minimize, not maximize, discontent and division within our society.
That was Congressman Peter Welch speaking to me yesterday. Today, we're reflecting on three incidents of mass violence in our country that we've experienced in the span of just a week. And we could add to that the many, many other incidents of violence inflicted on individuals that haven't made national headlines but still shake the communities where those victims and perpetrators live. We want to talk a little bit today about trauma, how to talk about it, when you're feeling scared, overwhelmed, sad, even if you're not personally connected to these incidents. And we'll look at actions people can or are taking in reaction to what they're learning, from combating white nationalism and racism to looking at community building, to action on gun control that many are pushing for at the federal level. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Rebecca Bell, a pediatric critical care physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center, Charlotte McCorkle, senior director of client services at Howard Center, the designated agency for mental health and developmental disability services, and a provider for substance use services in Chittenden County, and Patsy Fortney, a non-denominational hospital chaplain at the Central Vermont Medical Center in Berlin. Welcome to all three of you, and thank you for being here to help us reflect today. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
You know, you each have experience in how to talk about these things, how to maybe even know where to go to express your own grief or feelings of being overwhelmed or sadness, or to recognize that you need to have conversations with somebody or think carefully about how you're feeling and dealing. And so I'm curious if maybe you could just reflect for a moment on how you are feeling and processing and dealing with these things and if they're affecting you. Dr. Bell?
Yeah, of course. I think, like many people, these events have both the dual role where they are shocking, but also at the same time can be numbing because, you know, we hear that these events happen over and over again. I hear a lot of misinformation afterwards about causes and blame that is not helpful. And like Congressman Welch mentioned, of course, I feel really disheartened by some of the rhetoric and all of that wrapped together. It's difficult.
Do you immediately go to your sort of professional mode then as a way of coping, but also as a way of being useful to say, well, you know, here's how I'm going to deal with it and here's how I'm going to combat the misinformation and sort of deal with it that way?
Yeah, sometimes I get into the, well, actually mode. Well, actually, that's not true. But then sometimes I need to take a break. And I have found myself actually doing that over the weekend and this week and just saying, you know what, I feel like I'm back in this cycle of, you know, explaining again why, you know, mental illness is not a driver in these types of events and over again. And so sometimes just taking a break can really help.
Patsy, how about for you?
Well, for me, I find that when things like this happen, it tends to touch a sense of grief that is inside of us already. So for me, I do feel that sense of touching on other things in my life. As a chaplain, I speak with a lot of people in the hospital, family members, patients and staff who will talk about the way these things feel to them, but also their own griefs, because I think what happens is a lot of times people get touched in their personal stories. And my feeling is that, you know, what helps me and what has helped me and what has helped people that I work with, I think, is to be able to speak about those things as they're rising up. When I talk with I facilitate a grief and loss group in the psych unit at the hospital weekly, and I like to say to people, you know, grief touches grief. So when something happens, it often goes back to touch all the other things that we're holding that we have yet not spoken about.
How do you address your own grief when, I mean, holding other people's grief can be a wonderful way to feel useful and to do something and to share and to feel connected. But if you're talking about grief touching grief, you know, hearing other people's story and feeling the empathy that we all want to be feeling can be really difficult.
It can. And what I find for myself personally is that I have an incredible team that I work with in Central Vermont Medical Center. It's the palliative and spiritual care team. Department. And we sit down all day long with each other because we go into rooms and we're talking with people who are dying and we're talking with people who have deep griefs, and things happen in the hospital that are also very distressing. And I sit down with my folks pretty regularly and say, gee, I just had a really difficult conversation. And I find that having that kind of a work environment is crucial. And without that, I think it would be a lot more difficult for me.
So you don't hold your feelings in, even if you feel like, you know, my trauma or my grief isn't the same as somebody who's actively going through this mourning for somebody that they know and love.
No, when I'm with a patient and they're talking about grief, you know, I'm staying there with them. It's only if the situation touches my own situation and this has happened, you know, in the moment, I'm pretty much there. But then as I step out, even if I don't feel my grief, I know it's there because I know it has to be. And this happened to me not too long ago where I went and sat down with a colleague. I just sat down and I just burst into tears. So being aware that it's there, I guess, is helpful.
And it's okay to cry.
And it's okay to cry. I could go on and on about that, but I'll let other people speak.
Well, Charlotte, what about you? What are you thinking and feeling, and how do you deal with it?
I think this is a time that's so important to practice really intentional self-care so that we can be present as providers and as caring people, so that we're present for our clients and our community, but we're also taking care of ourselves and each other in the helping profession. And like Patsy's saying, really taking that time to step away from the work and pause and practice self-care.
You know, Dr. Bell mentioned that that other way that we sometimes cope, which is to feel numb. And that's something that Dr. David Ritu also wrote into us. He's a pediatric psychiatrist at UVM's Lerner College of Medicine. And he says, you know, this broadcast is appropriately focused on people who may be struggling to cope emotionally with these horrible tragedies. But it may be important to spend a minute thinking about the other side. As these stories come at us day after day, it's easy to lose our emotional response and begin to see these terrible events as commonplace or inevitable. That, to me, would be a tragedy in and of itself. So, Charlotte, how do you fight against that apathy that we can feel and that sometimes we feel just as a coping mechanism, like you just need to shut down because you can't read or feel any more of that grief coming at you?
I think it's really important to know when to get information and what information I need to be able to do my job and to be a human in this world, and what information that my colleagues or my family may need, but then also to know when to shut off the news and when to ask those questions about the facts and to respond with the "well, actually" statements that Dr. Bell was referring to, so that we're not becoming numb, but we're not overly invested in sensationalizing events like this, which still are rare, even though they're more common and so tragic.
Patsy, is it self-indulgent to feel grief over something that does not touch your own personal life, you know, to sort of feel this fully and to experience it as grief and want to talk about it as grief when it's not your story exactly?
This is a very an interesting question. And when I did some bereavement training, they spoke about Sandy Hook and what happened there with some of the families who felt like people were coming and putting, you know, stuffed animals down and weeping. And this felt very wrong to them. It felt something was being taken from them. And I think about that. I've thought about that since. And I'll say again that I think what happens for people is that we are actually feeling our own grief, but it's easier and safer to have it be out there in somebody else's story. But we need to be careful with people in that regard because we're unconscious. So sometimes we just do those things without thinking. But if people who are feeling that way could be helped to understand that something has been touched in them, I think it could be a really healing process for them as well.
Listeners, we're talking about grief, we're talking about healing, we're going to be talking about action as well, and some of the concrete things that people are thinking about after these three in a row really shocking incidents of mass violence and you know, shocking and rare but more commonplace than we'd like them to be. And so there's that tension that we're all feeling. If you'd like to share your perspective and your thoughts, maybe how you're feeling, what you're doing, and what questions you have that are just swirling around in your brain and perhaps in your conversations, you can call 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send us an email. Our email address is vermontedition@vpr.org, or share your thoughts publicly on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. Andrew in Richmond says the lack of empathy seems to be at the root of a cultural crisis in our country. What do your guests think of building community and understanding as ways to alleviate this crisis? I think there's a distance created with the devices in our lives, both from each other and the subjects of the consumed media. It strains the sense of togetherness that seemed more common in previous decades. Given that technology is so ingrained in our culture, can your guests provide insight into the importance of being present in everyday opportunities to build those critical social pieces? Dr. Bell, I think you're pointing here to Charlotte McCorkle. Charlotte, I guess it's you who has to tackle that.
I think building community and showing empathy and compassion in times like this, but also day-to-day, is so important, and giving those caring messages to our own family members, to our colleagues, and to our neighbors, so that people know that there are resources available and that there's support available and that we don't have to suffer alone. I think our devices just complicate things in many different ways, so that is a tricky question. I think devices can help people connect to resources in ways that may feel safer than reaching out by phone or in person, but also create a sense of constant information and potentially distraction from being present. And so creating opportunities to come together, again, as a family, as a community, as a neighborhood, are really important in times like this.
Dr. Bell, how do you talk to your young patients about all of this kind of stuff?
Well, we recommend that parents do talk about this, except for the very, very young patients, you know, under 3. Most children know or have a sense of that something has happened. And so we do recommend that parents talk to their children and actually bring it up. A lot of parents want to say, well, what if I bring it up and then I introduce these ideas? And really the key is to bring it up and then to listen. And to listen and hear what they say, hear what they're worried about, hear what their concerns are. And they may be very different than what you're expecting, depending on their age and where they are developmentally. And so that piece is really important. We recommend frequently checking in. And kids might not want to talk about it at first, but then they might want to talk about it later. Other recommendations would be to ask what their friends are talking about. So it's a common way to get kids to talk is to say, are people talking about this at school? What are they saying? And they can often communicate that way. And then just to provide some reassurance. And I think the other thing that parents can do is just to really role model coping, and you yourself taking breaks from the news, you yourself doing things as a family, that piece is really important and it has a strong impact on how children can react to the news as well.
I'll also direct listeners to VPR.org if you'd like more of a conversation on how to talk to young people about violence in the news. We actually have a But Why episode about that, But Why, our podcast for kids, has a special episode for parents about talking to your kids about violence in the news, which sadly is relevant frequently. And so we keep bringing that episode back. So you'll find that at VPR.org. Louder Good on Reddit writes in to say, there is a core cultural problem we need to solve for society to deal with this kind of person, speaking of the people who are perpetrators of violence, before they become radicalized. This is hard. Most of these shooters have been taught to feel victimized by society, to blame others who are not like them or who they perceive as having damaged them. They're also inclined to not seek help. That's seen as a weakness, which is unacceptable and even shameful for them. If we don't find a way to address this, we're just kicking the can down the road. And Mary Gannon, an independent consultant and educator on issues of racial and social justice from Brattleboro, emailed in to put a fine point on these questions about white nationalism in particular. She writes, in light of the violent acts perpetrated in El Paso, it's critical to use the language of white supremacy and white nationalism to accurately identify the racist ideology and acts that we continue to witness in this country. White supremacy is not limited to the KKK. Our social institutions and policies that marginalize black and brown communities are based in white supremacist culture, which dictates a dominant norm about white as superior to other racial groups. We need to better understand and analyze racism as part of our social institutions. If we expand the conversation in this country to engage with ideas of white supremacy beyond just discussing racism, we can begin to craft more effective responses and interventions. And let's turn to this question of racism, of white extremism, white nationalism. Natahe Stoddard is a builder and landscaper in the Northeast Kingdom who also delivers programs and workshops about racism and white supremacy in the workplace and schools. He's worked with groups like the Peace and Justice Center of Vermont and the Vermont Racial Justice Alliance. And he joins us on the phone now to talk a little bit about racism and white nationalism and ways to address that in our society. Natahe, welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much.
So I'd love your thoughts first, just your initial reactions and where you go in this question of racism and white nationalism and extreme racism that leads to violence.
Okay, thank you. I personally prefer to use the term white supremacy. I feel like white nationalism is a euphemism of types, as though folks are working actually toward their own goals rather than working against other people's access to equal rights. And space, but I really appreciate that y'all talking about access to guns and mental health. I really do think that as a elephant in the room is white supremacy culture proper and white supremacist ideology. And if I can just speak real quick to sort of the history here, we have a constant thread through our entire history of white supremacist violence, which is manifest in a couple ways. Impunity for white violence and threats. This goes back to forced removal of indigenous folks from their own land, including right here in Dakina, the land that we live on, to human enslavement, torture, and child rape committed even by founding fathers who we hail, to today, you know, there are, a Louisiana cop threatened the life of a congresswoman of color and maybe has lost his job by now, but has no criminal sanctions. And just a year or so ago, we had a child in Claremont, New Hampshire, who had survived an attempted lynching, and there were no legal repercussions for the folks who committed that, including folks who came to a memorial service with a Confederate flag, sort of threatening people there. Also, historic impunity for white terrorist organizations, from the Ku Klux Klan to the Patriot Front, which is busy in Vermont trying to get access to the minds of our children right now. And this is mixed with the constant criminalization of just the existence of people of color in our society, whether you're talking about enslavement and forced removal from land to black codes and Jim Crow to currently stop and frisk laws, which have been found to be unconstitutional, even as they're still employed.
So Natahe, you see all of this coming together in our culture and then, you know, connecting to these extreme events of mass violence. Do you see them as a cultural problem that becomes so pervasive that it leads to this violence? Or where's the connection for you?
The connection for me is that, you know, white skin privileged people are the one group of people who sort of can safely ignore these things. So we have times in our history where we are, as a broader culture, made to look at these things. This is one of those times, but that this is a constant in our life throughout, and that we really need to change thinking about these things as either one-off or, you know, as not the norm, and really get at trying to get at a solution. If I can say, you know, I think some of the root of this is that every time that white skin privileged, poor working people and middle class people work together with people of color toward our shared interests, the very wealthiest people and corporations in our country employ campaigns of violence and backlash to separate us from our interests. I'd love to speak on one quick example.
But I also want to, so, you know, one of the questions here is then, okay, so what are the short term and the longer term solutions then that people can be working toward, knowing that history and maybe reading deeper into the history and the certainly the roots of mass violence that are not limited to today when it comes to how people of color have been treated in this country? But what do we do?
Yeah, I can. I'm happy to give you just a sort of a quick list of micro and macro things. It would be lovely to get to expand on one or two of those ideas. I'm trying to get into a little of history because it is important for us to be able to employ any of those solutions, you know, to really get a sort of hold on where we are. But on a sort of micro level, I would suggest recognizing and owning whiteness, which I would love to expand on a little bit in a second, but I'll just list these things down. Listening to black and brown folks and believing them. And I don't necessarily mean like stressing out every person of color in your life by employing them as your own personal educator. But, you know, we live in an internet age and there's a lot of education that we can go access ourselves, as well as, you know, I know that this show in the past has had folks but I would encourage in the future, you know, having more voices of folks of color in organizations led by folks of color. Migrant Justice, Vermont Racial Justice Alliance, Vermont Coalition for Ethnic and Social Equity in Schools, and there are many more to this. I would suggest that we support the current ethnic studies bill in Vermont, which is just in its infancy, and we have to see work out. We need to insist that we have a different access to historic political and economic education in our schools. We've sort of dumbed down a lot of what we're doing in schools to, we now have humanities classes like in the place of what used to be more space getting into civics, social studies, history, English, you know, now it's all in one sort of space. Supporting reparations, we in this state, we actually have a House Bill 478 that's sort of sitting in House government operations, not supported. And I know that people, especially in such a white state, you know, maybe feel a way about that. But I would like to say, as a thing to do, connecting poor, and this can be done on any many levels, okay? Connecting poor and working white folks with their interests. Interest, by the way, that we share with our neighbors of color, and separating us as white people from our fears. Okay. And so, if I can say like an example of that is, you know, if white people worked with people of color toward our shared interests, we will get them. You know, there's a saying, when we fight, we win. And these shared interests are, you know, let me just list healthcare, pensions, affordable housing, affordable food, jobs, safety, clean air, clean water. These are all things that we all need, right?
Well, let me stop you there for a moment and say, you know, this is a good place to start. And as you've said, Nadahe, and there's a lot more to talk about and a lot more to discuss in this and to expand upon. And, you know, we'd love to put some of your ideas on our webpage at vpr.org for people to explore more. We're going to continue talking about these issues, and we're going to talk specifically about guns. We're going to talk about mental health coming up. So I'm going to leave it there with you for now. But if you want to share your list with us, Nadahe, we'd love to hear more about how each of us can work on this within our own communities and within our own lives. Thank you for being a part of the show today.
Thank you.
Nadahe Stoddard is a builder and landscaper, and he works on programs and workshops about racism and white supremacy in the workplace and in schools. Nancy in East Hardwick says several things that have resonated with me in light of the continued horribleness of mass shootings. One, treat these like national terrorism events, just the way we have been radicalized by ISIS. Two, we should all stop using the word manifesto for any writings of shooters. We should use negative words like rant to devalue these writings. Manifesto gives action and thoughts value. And Head Gasket Idiot on Reddit says, we obviously have deep cultural issues here. We need to sort out racism and incels and nationalism. Today, we're talking about mass violence and how we react to it, ways to cope with feelings of helplessness, and actions people can take in reaction to these events that shake the public consciousness. We're talking with Charlotte McCorkle, Senior Director of Client Services at Howard Center, Rebecca Bell, a pediatric critical care physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center, and Patsy Fortney, a non-denominational hospital chaplain at the Central Vermont Medical Center in Berlin. You know, one of the ways that people are addressing change and action and their own feelings in light of these incidents is to talk about guns and gun control, guns used in all of these incidents of mass violence that we've been talking about just in the last few days. Porter R House 42 says, we've gone mad. My children have active shooter drills at school. My God, the utter inhumanity of that. If more guns means less crime, where was the good guy with the gun who was supposed to save everybody? We can't keep living like this. And in another post, this person adds, it's the guns. Don't play the NRA trick of convincing hunters that everybody wants to take away deer season. Far from it. I grew up hunting. I still do. I'm completely opposed to civilian ownership of military-grade weaponry. But Jay Sled says, you know, there's no easy answer, and writes, I'm a gun owner, a lefty, and the moderator of Reddit's liberal gun owners group. I come to this conversation in good faith. I'm sorry, your favorite gun control solution won't work. I say this with a lot of sadness. I wish there was an easy fix, but there really isn't. They fail because they're practically impossible to enact in the U.S. The way to eliminate gun violence is to eliminate guns. In the U.S., this means either legal elimination, which means eliminating the Second Amendment. This will never happen. Or it means social or cultural elimination, which is unlikely to happen. The way to eliminate violence is to remove the reasons that people commit violence. This more or less reduces to eliminate economic inequality. I'm a huge proponent of the concept, but it's literally an effort involving the whole history of humanity, and there is not an easy answer. So a couple different thoughts on guns there, and we'll get a few more. Ron is calling in from Essex. Hi, Ron. Go right ahead.
Hi. As a parent of a son who has schizophrenia, you know, when you have a pet at home, you know, you love the pet. Almost 99.9% of the time, they're friendly and there's no problem. But it's still a wild animal. And there could be a day when that dog bites. And I hate to use that analogy, but the same is true for severely mentally ill people. You know, medications help and all kinds of therapies help. But when they get delusional, things can happen. And one of the solutions that I'd like to see is for long rifle weapons, AR-15s or what have you, military grade, is you should not be able to purchase a gun like that if you're 26 and below. The mind doesn't fully develop till then. People who are the age of 26 usually have completed college. They have a stable career. They have a stable relationship or even get married. There's less chance of a person like that using a weapon in a mass shooting.
So, Ron, let me stop you there. Ron's bringing in questions of both mental health and guns. So we can dive right into both topics because those are both important. And sometimes they're conflated. Often they're conflated. We heard from President Trump on that. Mental illness pulls the trigger, he said. It's not about the gun. So let's talk about both. And we can both tease them apart and talk about how they're connected. Dr. Bell, would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. So mental illness is not the driver of violence that oftentimes people think it is. So those with serious mental illness like schizophrenia are more likely to be victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators of violence. And that's really important to remember. And that's all types of violence. When you look at mass shootings in particular, those perpetrators do not have history of serious mental illness. Committing a heinous act does not mean someone is mentally ill. And that's really important. And it's important because our mental health providers, professionals are every time this happens, they're saying blaming this on mental illness is both, the American Psychological Association said, it's both unfounded and stigmatizing. So we need to be really careful in the way we talk about this.
But it's hard because I think people say there's no way a sane person could do that. And so I think part of the question is teasing apart what our words mean, because no, I think there's a differentiation between clinical mental illness and somebody who does a heinous act whose brain is not functioning the way any rational person's brain should. So you're not saying these people are well. You're just saying they don't have a clinical mental illness as defined by what we consider treatable clinical mental illness.
That's exactly right. It's not you know, it's not something that we need to put on the mental health profession to fix. A lot of these people will display really maladaptive thinking and behavior, and those can fall under antisocial and psychopathy, but that's not treatable in the way that we think about other types of mental illness. And that's where we get the stigma, is that people, the general public, confuse those things. I will say for Ron and for other folks who are listening, specifically about the guns, and separate from, importantly, looking at weapons, looking at types of weapons, looking at ammunition and how people can obtain them, it is hard to prevent people who have real red flags and really are at risk for committing violence from obtaining firearms in the way our laws are set up right now. So the biggest risk is someone who's actually behaved in a violent manner. So certainly anyone, domestic violence is a big red flag, but preludes to domestic violence, stalking, harassing, those types of things are big red flags that might not necessarily prevent someone from getting a firearm. There are things that we can do today to keep our communities safe around firearms. One is, if you're living in a home with firearms and you feel unsafe, you can consider removing the firearms. That's one option. If that's not an option to you, I want to remind folks that the Vermont passed an extreme risk protection order last year. And that means that family members can go to the police, law enforcement, and ask them to petition a judge to remove firearms. The other really important piece is, a lot of firearms are being used, especially when young people use firearms, whether on themselves or in public spaces, in schools or in the home. These are unsecured firearms. So talking about safely storing firearms in a way that people cannot get access to them. So children can't get access. People who shouldn't get access, it decreases the likelihood of theft. And that means that all gun owners really need to store their firearms locked up, unloaded, with the ammunition stored separately and locked up. And we as a community can talk to each other about that. That's a really tangible thing that every one of us can do. If we're frustrated about legislation, there's other things we can do to talk about creating a culture of gun safety.
Charlotte?
One thing that's notable is that the National Council for Behavioral Health just released a report called Mass Violence in America. And the report says that people with serious mental illness are responsible for less than 4% of all violence and less than 1/3 of mass violence. So thinking about Ron's comment and just in general, it's really important that we don't fear people with mental illness and we don't attribute that to violence in our community.
Before we end, Patsy Fortney, I wonder if you could just help us think about how to move forward here. I mean, this is an ongoing conversation and certainly ongoing grief, but also action for people.
Right. I would say that as long as I've been a chaplain and increasingly as time goes on, I see that grief that's been unacknowledged and unprocessed is at the root of so much of the suffering that I see with psychiatric patients and also with patients in the hospital who are dealing with just serious illness. What I have found to be really helpful, and I've learned this from the people I work with, particularly on the psych unit there, is that speaking our stories, saying what happened, is very healing. And more than anything, I think that that's something that we need to be able to have as a culture, the openness to speak and the willingness to listen without trying to fix or change, because it is a healing process that we're each individually going through.
Yes, and we all have the ability to try to take action within ourselves and within our own families and communities at this point. I want to thank all three of you for being a part of this conversation. Charlotte McCorkle, Senior Director of Client Services at Howard Center, Patsy Fortney, a non-denominational hospital chaplain at the Central Vermont Medical Center in Berlin, and Rebecca Bell, a pediatric critical care physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Thanks to all three of you for being here.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.